Hello, my name is Haley Palumbo, and this is Unknown America on WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. Unknown America is a weekly radio show that casts a light on the lesser-known people, places, events, and otherwise overlooked aspects of United States history, be they mysterious, dark, comical, strange, or otherwise valuable. This episode is about the Midwestern tourist attraction, The House on the Rock, an utterly mind-boggling testament to one reclusive Wisconsinite's disposable wealth and perhaps lunacy. Somewhere in between Dodgeville and Spring Green, Wisconsin, there's what some would refer to as a tourist attraction called the House on the Rock. The House on the Rock defies all description and rational explanation. Even Wikipedia doesn't really know what to call it other than a tourist attraction, and a bit more descriptively, a complex of unconventional interests, which I find to be a bit more faithful a statement to the source material. Maybe you'd refer to it as a museum. I don't know what else to call it, at least if I were trying to list it in a directory or a phone book. It's not a real house. Nobody lives there, not that I know of. It's not a store because you can't buy anything. It's more of a showcase of endless impulse purchases, hoarding and fabrications, a maze of stuff. None of that is hyperbole or exaggeration in the slightest. I suppose if a random person were to ask me what the House on the Rock in Spring Green, Wisconsin is, in as few words as possible, I would tell them it's a gigantic building filled with a rich dead architect's collection of, well, everything. Guns, suits of armor, taxidermied animals, dollhouses, and then has a giant carousel inside of it. And automatic orchestras, not just one, but a whole bunch. And some of it was created from trash the architect found and passed off as real. And all of it, maybe, probably, was constructed for the sole purpose of making this rich dead architect more money so he can build more buildings. The House on the Rock is spitefully maximalist and organized in a way that only the creator could truly explain. Its contents range from highly valuable to totally valueless, with the bulk of the items resting somewhere in the middle and veering towards the latter, even to the point of being likely recreations of the real thing constructed from garbage. And no matter how much you relay its contents or your experiences there to people, you'll never tell them the full story just because there's so much there and everywhere you turn you see something you hadn't seen the last time you went. It is a sensory hurricane, a flea market kaleidoscope. Everywhere you look, there's more and more and more, unfurling like a rug before you, frying your senses, leaving you overstimulated, incredulous, baffled, gasping with awe, and at least in my experience, hungry for sleep. It is one of many, many things a man can do with several millions of dollars. This man's name was Alex Jordan Jr., Wisconsin's very own Howard Hughes of Roadside Entertainment. A story told by Madison, Wisconsin native, industrial photographer, outsider artist, and graphic designer Sid Boyum places the inspiration for The House on the Rock in a meeting between Alex Jordan Jr. and Frank Lloyd Wright. Jordan supposedly drove with Sid Boyum to show Wright the plans for a building, the Via Maria in Madison. Jordan idolized the famous architect and hoped for his approval. Wright looked at the plans and told Jordan,
"I wouldn't hire you to design a cheese crate or a chicken coop. You're not capable."
On the drive home, Jordan angrily pointed at a spire of rock and told Boyum,
"I'm going to put up a Japanese house on one of those pinnacle rocks and advertise it."
According to one of Jordan Jr.'s biographers, Wright apparently didn't forget the incident and complained publicly to county officials about the house the Jordans were building and bought a nearby piece of property to get back at Jordan. Not only is this interaction out of character, it's also disproven by fact. Frank Lloyd Wright was in Japan working on the Imperial Hotel when this interaction allegedly took place. Also, when this would have occurred, the artist that Jordan allegedly expressed his intentions for the spire of rock to would have been 9 years old. The legitimacy of this account is called into question frequently. Allegedly, Sid Boyum, a literal world champion liar at Burlington, Wisconsin's Liars Club, wanted to paint Alex Jordan Jr. out as a P.T. Barnum character, a man who didn't mind stretching the truth to make a few extra bucks. He didn't really need to fabricate a story, though, because as it turns out, the truth wasn't all that far off. Alex Jordan Jr. was, by all accounts, reclusive. There's not a ton of public information about him, which adds to the mystique. Accounts from his employees, friends, and relatives, some scorned, so take this with a grain of salt, describe a complicated man who either loved people deeply or despised them. He, according to one biographer, did not enjoy or seek out personal publicity, and only really continued to develop the house to finance his elaborate electronic and architectural projects, yet he created a place so strange and memorable that he is an utterly impossible figure to ignore when discussing his work. He had seemingly no problem at all recreating antiques and valuables with things he found around or encouraging others to do it for him. Whether this was to entertain people, entertain himself, or to make money, it is not known with certainty, but it's likely it's some combination of the three. The house on the rock was built on top of Deer Shelter Rock, a tall column of rock in Iowa County, Wisconsin. The architecture of the house itself was heavily inspired by one of Alex Jordan Jr.'s former hero turned imaginary enemy, Frank Lloyd Wright. Alex didn't get the style quite right, though. How could he? While the visual elements of a Frank Lloyd Wright work are there, they're Frankenstein together in a somewhat alarming fashion. Seemingly following the contours of rock upon which they are built, rather than any precise vision the architect had when he sat down to plan, more like a sculptor than an architect. This is compounded by the fact that every passing decade of Jordan Jr.'s lifetime, a new wing was built that contained a new exhibit, and these wings often didn't obey the architectural style of the original building, making for a truly bizarre-looking structure, an architectural chimera of sorts, melting into the spire of rocks underneath it. It's a strange thing to see. Funnily enough, the house is in the same town as Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin studio and home. This was likely far from being a coincidence. Taliesin is beautiful, even in its third incarnation. The first two had burned down, one on behalf of a disgruntled employee, and the other due to faulty electricity. When viewed as a duo, it's easy to see the wild and severe contrast between the two. Yet they share a lot of architectural similarities. The house on the rock is Taliesin's cartoon inverse, sort of like looking at it in a funhouse mirror. Taliesin is sparse, with ample natural light, wide open space, and a simple and understated exterior, but it shares an undeniable silhouette with its counterpart. They're so different that they shouldn't exist on the same planet, but it's easy to see where inspiration was likely drawn by Jordan Jr. when designing his work. Both men are, as writer Jane Smiley put it, eccentric and single-minded, but one charging full speed ahead towards lunacy, and one taking a more subdued approach to his method of creation. I'll let you decide which is which. Returning to the topic of Alex Jordan Jr.'s personal history, the House on the Rock's website has a bit of a different tale to tell. Alex Jordan Jr. was born in Madison, Wisconsin, in 1914, where he lived his entire life. After graduating high school, he attended the University of Wisconsin, where he had wanted to major in pre-med. After some time there, he found himself growing very restless with college. It limited him and his increasingly more ambitious ideas. After college, he worked for Rayovac and helped his father maintain an apartment building. This is where he gained knowledge of construction. During World War II, he worked at an ammunition factory. In the 1940s, Jordan Jr. discovered Deer Shelter Rock and began having small picnics on top of it. Then he started bringing his tent. One night, his tent blew away, and from that day on, he decided he wanted to build something more stable, which is how he got the idea for House on the Rock. He built a small studio with a fireplace after renting the rock and a bit of land around it from a farmer. And when his parents saw the work he was doing and heard his ideas, they helped him buy the entire 240-acre property. Jordan Jr. built the house initially not at all for tourists, but mostly for himself. He was so irritated by people ceaselessly trying to get a closer look at his private creation that he began charging a 50-cent admission fee to get people to go away. But it turns out people were more than willing to pay. He continued his work on the house as it started resembling what it looks like today. He never married or had children. He just worked at the House on the Rock with who is described as his companion and love of his life, Jenny Olson, who lived in the apartment right next to his. He was totally devoted to the House on the Rock. It was his only source of income. Every dime he made went back into the care and keeping of the place. He spent the remainder of his healthful life working on it, but in 1964, after smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day, drinking, eating whenever he was hungry and sleeping whenever he wanted, he had a serious heart attack that damaged 30% of it. Then, in 1972, he was involved in a nearly fatal car accident in which he broke his neck. This marked the beginning of the end for Alex because he was in chronic pain. On December 14, 1988, Alex realized he no longer had the physical or mental capacity to own the House on the Rock and sold it to a business associate, Art Donaldson. A collector and businessman, he shared many interests with Alex. Alex trusted Art to take care of his work, whose family still owns the House on the Rock as a privately held business. Alex took the title of artistic director after the sale. While his body ended up failing, he remained creatively viable until the end. He was hospitalized on October 11th of 1989 and died roughly 1 month later. At his request, his ashes were spread over the House on the Rock, which happened in December of 1989. That is the end of the house's account of the life of Alex Jordan Jr. Whether or not it is more or less accurate than the other accounts I have read, I could not say. One could argue that since it comes directly from the source, it is more accurate than any other account. On the other hand, it could be dramatized or exaggerated in some way. This is the pain point I'm encountering in my research about the house. Unlike a whole lot of history, where everyone can generally agree upon one story, there are many about Alex Jordan Jr. and his life, and only a slight majority of sources seem to agree. The account of it you're hearing is a somewhat curated look at what most seem to generally agree upon, so take all of it with a grain of salt. What all sources I encountered but Wikipedia do have in common is that they're emotionally biased or written skeptically. Even the most popular biography written about Alex Jordan Jr. is written from the perspective of someone who thinks he's probably a con artist. Something I saw all sources agree upon, though, is that Alex Jordan Jr. built the House on the Rock mostly for himself initially and started charging a fee for admission to get people to leave. Whether or not this ended up being good or bad to him at the end of his life is uncertain, but he did indeed seem to make the house his life's work. If he desired a more reclusive way of living and could not stand the company of others, he had a funny way of showing it. But who knows? People contain multitudes, and it's obvious that whoever had the mental capacity to create something as bizarre and massive as the House on the Rock is a very complicated person. Walking into the House on the Rock, everything seems relatively normal. The entrance in no way prepares you for what you're about to see. But after paying admission and entering the foundational aspect of the House on the Rock, the house itself, a Frank Lloyd Wright meets 1960s bachelor pad compound, combined with dark corners, low ceilings, and hookah lounge-style furniture, you start to feel something in the pit of your stomach, like things are about to spiral out of control very, very quickly. And there are tells before they do. A random bassinet on a ledge above a doorway for no obvious reason. A stray doll in a corner somewhere. Then before you know it, you're deep within a maze of chaotic clutter from which there is no obvious exit, and it goes on this way for many hours before you're finally able to leave. I'm about to relay to you a list of the contents of the house on the rock, by no means complete. These are just the strangest things I saw on one of my visits there. The house on the rock contains, in part, a two-scale recreation of an early 20th century American town, complete with storefronts, cars, and streets. A large collection of automated orchestras and music machines, which are partly illusion. Some of the instruments play, but the strings and woodwinds in particular do not. Their sound is produced by organ pipes, while visitors are fooled by the motion of the instruments. Old circus memorabilia. A 200-foot statue of a whale-like creature and a squid fighting each other. Hundreds of cars. Some genuine, most replicas, although in most cases it is not indicated which is which. The largest indoor carousel in the world, above which hangs 182 chandeliers and many mannequin angels. A koi pond with 14-foot waterfalls. Bathrooms decorated with taxidermied animals, mannequins, and fake flowers. The infinity room, a 218-foot structure protruding from the house on the rock that gets narrower and narrower, creating an optical illusion that it goes on forever. A massive hangar filled with two-scale models of airplanes. Several antique stores worth of gaudy and dusty antiques. A strength tester complete with hammer, like you'd see at a carnival or a state fair. A fully functional tarot card reading automaton. A collection of spittoons and tobacco. A collection of old cameras. Human-sized and seemingly functional music boxes. A fully functional model railroad. Dioramas of everything you can think of spread throughout. I lost count of how many. A collection of fully furnished Victorian dollhouses. Carved ivory, the legitimacy of which should likely be questioned. An automated band that honks out a demented version of Octopus's Garden by the Beatles. A vast collection of firearms, antiques included, the legitimacy of which should likely be questioned. A series of what were claimed by Jordan Jr. to be authentic Tiffany lamps, later proven to be fake. An allegedly authentic car from the 1920s that was actually built from motorcycle parts and an old carriage, and seemingly authentic suits of armor fabricated by associates of Alex Jordan Jr. This is not even half of the collection. It's probably not even a tenth. There's no such thing as overstatement when describing the house on the rock. There will always be much, much more to it than whatever you relay to whoever you're talking to, no matter how long you talk. It inspires an immediate sort of amnesia in a person, like your brain is so overloaded by the sheer amount of sensory input it is being fed that it either short circuits or purposefully leaves things out to free up bandwidth for other things. Some things about the house I only remembered months later while doing a completely unrelated task. These memories were either ghostly and vague, like navigating a dream or looking at an underdeveloped photo from a pinhole camera, were shocking in their quality and clarity, like I was still there observing it firsthand. There was no middle ground. Photographs and video were seemingly allowed, so one could revisit their memories firsthand, but I was too distracted on both my visit as a child and my visit as an adult to do such a thing. View my list as a fractal that expands the closer you get to it, because it's by no means a solid testament to the real thing. As I'm sure you can surmise after hearing my list, the reclusive Jordan Jr. seemingly had no problem stretching the truth and would frequently fib about the origin of items being authentic and not created from materials off-site by what he vaguely referred to as associates. In 1978, a disgruntled employee even reported Alex Jordan Jr. and House on the Rock for consumer fraud, which resulted in a thorough investigation of the site. As a result of said investigation, the printed brochure was pulled and rewritten, and all of the signs alleging all structures and items were totally and completely real were removed and destroyed. One can assume this was done as discreetly as possible, as to not raise questions. The names of the exhibit were allowed to stay up. This encouraged viewers to come to their own conclusions, whatever they wished them to be, without providing a great amount of detail swaying them in one direction or the other. Jordan Jr. likely hoped his customers would simply make up their own story in favor of him from the vague handful of ingredients he supplied them with, and he wouldn't have to lie outright, thus avoiding the long arm of the law and any repercussions that came with it, including receiving a fine or worse, being shut down. Additionally, the natural conclusion can be drawn that if one or even a few fake things among a handful of real things, chances are the fake thing is totally real and there's no need for suspicion. It's much easier to suspect the legitimacy of a thing when the fake is standing alone and not lost in a crowd of very similar company. Alex Jordan Jr. likely recognized this and consequentially elected to make his collections a potpourri of simulacrum rather than being entirely fake. If these two Model T cars are real, why would the third be built from lawnmowers or parts of a baby carriage? That wouldn't make any sense. The interesting thing about the House on the Rock is that this doesn't matter so much. In fact, I wouldn't suspect great outrage if the public, even after paying, were told that many relics they were viewing were not real, but fabricated. When visiting the House on the Rock, you're not viewing it in the way you would a furniture store or a grocery list, systematically itemizing everything you just saw for purchase. You're observing it in the way you would have a dream. Who is bent over with a magnifying glass, nitpicking or questioning reality in a dream? One generally doesn't leave the house wanting to write a review, they leave trying to figure out if whatever they just saw really happened, which makes it a profound experience. One of the strangest things on my list is the Infinity Room. It's billed as a top attraction and selling point of the house, with its image plastered on mugs, shot glasses, commemorative coins, and the like. It's a long, narrow structure that extends out over the valley below, jutting violently out of the side of the building. It is constructed almost entirely of glass, a narrow walkway surrounded by windows on all sides. As visitors traverse the walkway, they experience the sensation of being suspended in midair, with panoramic views of the surrounding landscape and the feeling of infinite space stretching out before them. It gets narrower and narrower until the footpath vanishes and the structure comes to a pointed end. If I remember correctly, there is a potted plant at the very end of the Infinity Room, but then again, that could be my brain creating an amusing detail where there isn't one to add some touchstone to reality to the bizarre sight, a thing that I recognize and am certain of. If anyone listening would like to tell me if the Infinity Room actually has a potted plant at the end of it, email me at haley@haleypalumbo.com. I would greatly appreciate it. In short, when viewing the Infinity Room, you get the feeling that Alex Jordan Jr. would have happily defied the laws of physics if he were permitted to do so, but he couldn't, so he built this thing instead. That's the strangest thing about every part of this place. It seems like Jordan Jr.'s primary goal was to defy any sense of logic and reason. It's like what are referred to as spite houses, structures built simply to spite another for existing. But the House on the Rock was conceived of and built in spite of sanity. It's like if your neighbor were to build his house directly in your sunlight, mostly just to get your goat. But Alex Jordan Jr. built what he did for the sole purpose of making you lose your mind, laughing the entire time. The indoor tour ends with the House on the Rock's tremendous indoor carousel, the largest indoor carousel in the world, dizzying in its magnitude. The carousel is blood red and gold and situated in one of the darkest rooms in the house, with 269 animals, 20,000 lights, 183 chandeliers, and dozens of fully-sized mannequin angels hanging overhead. There's not a single horse on the carousel itself. However, a wall adjacent to the carousel is hung with many carousel horses, like the horses on the carousel were at one point removed and replaced, a final nod to the air of defiance of logic and convention the place carries throughout. Through the exit is a Japanese-style garden with a large, loud waterfall, aggressive even in its tranquility, more like a water park than an oasis. The long walk you take back to your car allows you to regain your composure to some degree, but even as I headed back, I felt intoxicated. I couldn't help but ask myself, is this really happening, or am I just looking at another collection? Is this my life, or is it just thoughts, feelings, and memories arranged to look like one? To some, going to the House on the Rock could be an unpleasant experience. Anyone with even a faint streak of minimalistic inclination, or alternately, any sense of claustrophobia in their blood, would likely lose their mind. Everything is exactly as dusty as you would expect. It would take a team of 100 people to clean the place thoroughly, and I wouldn't be surprised if no one has ever even attempted. In some areas, the ceilings are low, the rooms are very dark, and when too many people are in there, it's very difficult to move at will. But to a certain kind of person, the House on the Rock is an impressive feat by somebody with few moral qualms about perhaps scamming people who didn't care if they were being scammed or not. My opinion is that it takes all kinds. Personally, I'd shake Alex Jordan Jr.'s hand and ask him what on earth he was thinking. My guess is he wouldn't have a straight answer. I'll conclude with a quote by late-in-life associate of Alex Jordan Jr. that sums him up a bit better than any of my observations here could. When asked about the authenticity of the relics in the House on the Rock, the associate had this to say.
We were creating entertainment. We weren't making a historically accurate representation. There was never any need to worry about historical accuracy. We were creating a fun place. We could fabricate any antiques we wanted to. That was the fun of it. It was just one guy's great big sandbox where he kept building stuff. I suspect that Jordan would pay more for a good copy than he would an original because he could sit in a corner and laugh about the way he fooled everyone.
This has been Unknown America on WGXC, Acre 90.7 FM. Haley Palumbo, signing off.